The Full English Breakfast Show, in association with Air France. Our guest this morning is Gavin Sharp, a UK qualified psychotherapist, sex therapist and relationship expert. He works with individuals and couples, helping them to make profound changes in their relationships and lives. Gavin, good morning.
Good morning.
Relax and tell me about your childhood.
How long have you got?
Oh, we've got all morning. No, just kidding. I'd like... First of all, by the way, you do a very good impression of Paul McKenna, if I may say.
Is that right?
Yeah, you look quite like him.
Is that good or bad?
It's good. It's okay. Good. So I think you're kind of in the same line of business, really. Although he's more of a magician than a psychotherapist, but he does offer that kind of advice as well. Anyway.
Look into my eyes, Rob. Look into my eyes.
Enough about that. How did you first get... What persuaded you to train as a psychotherapist?
I spent years first working in the city, and I... realized at some point, like lots of us do, that I wasn't really enjoying life. I wasn't feeling fulfilled. And I believe that we kind of come into this world with the potential to become the best version of ourselves. And I was in the city and I felt like it was soul destroying. I didn't feel I was connecting with people. I was connecting with focused on the bottom line, and I wanted to do something that would be more meaningful.
It was a big wrench, though, changing like that in the middle of, you know, having a stable career and everything.
It was. It was a huge change, but I'm a firm believer that when we relax enough and we allow ourselves to kind of listen to what our heart says, cliched though it may be, then we find the answers.
Right, but I mean, a lot of people would be very, very fearful of making that bigger change, so your advice to people is, you know, have the courage of your convictions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. Do you have a couch?
I do have a couch. I do. I don't know why I have a couch, because nobody ever lies on it, but I think it just goes with the, you know, I have my therapy office and I have to have a couch. And sometimes it's an icebreaker. Sometimes people come in and people say, do you want me to lie down? Right? Well, if you want to, you can.
Mm. I think I prefer a reclining armchair, one of those ones with a swivel, you know.
It's an armchair. It's not reclining. I mean, you can recline, but you'll fall over, so yeah.
So it's not a chaise longue, then?
it's not, no.
You must have had some pretty weird experiences over the years. I mean, I know you can't mention anyone specifically, but what's some of the oddest things that have happened to you?
I think probably one of the oddest was probably very early on in my career as a therapist, and I was in probably about the second session of seeing someone, and he'd come in for, he was having some, let's say, intimate problems in the bedroom. And we got to the second session. He sort of said, well, can I ask, when do we start? And I said, well, you know, we've started. And he said, no, I mean, when do we actually start, you know, us? And I kind of looked at him and I said, look, I realize that you're paying by the hour, but that's not the kind of service that I offer. And strangely enough, he didn't come back.
Yeah, you could charge by the minute for that, couldn't you? Now, you treat addiction as well as just couples problems. I mean, people often say that you're born with an addictive personality or not. Do you think there is a root cause of all addictions, or is it too complicated to say that?
I think it is complicated. I think for a large number of people who develop addictions, I think it starts with some kind of trauma in childhood. Not always, but there's something that has manifested itself. And, you know, most addictions, whether it's gambling, whether it's sex, whether it's drink, what am I looking to do? I'm looking to escape something. There's something in my life that I'm uncomfortable about. And that usually stems from childhood. But we do know that, you know, to answer your question, there are other factors. Genetics do play a part. It's a mixture of things. But I would say it's a mixture probably mostly of childhood trauma and some genetics.
And peer pressure as well, no doubt.
Oh, peer pressure plays a huge part into our childhood. I mean, again, if I've been brought up in a family and I feel secure and I'm stable, then I am less likely to succumb to peer pressure. Or I might be a kid in my adolescence and I may experiment a bit with alcohol and with substances, but I'm less likely to develop an addiction because actually as an individual, I feel held and supported in my family unit.
You mentioned childhood there, and I jokingly made reference to it at the start of the interview, but I mean, it is something that psychotherapists are very keen to get to grips with in clients, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a cliche to say it, but, you know, we are who we were. And the way I love in my relationships is, you know, there's a direct correlation to the way that I was loved as a kid. So if I grew up in an environment and dad was an alcoholic or mum wasn't that emotionally present, if there's some kind of abandonment there, well, I'm going to grow up as an adult and I'm going to fear abandonment and I'm going to feel frightened to let go in my relationships. And sometimes it's not that something bad happened to us in our childhood. Sometimes it's that there was an absence of something good. So sometimes people come to therapy and they say, well, you know what? I had a pretty good childhood. I mean, there was food on the table. We went on holidays. And then I'll say, well, what was life like when you were growing up? And then they'll say, well, actually, I was one of four children. Parents weren't really around that much. So we can kind of conclude that you were loved, you were fortunate, that there may have been an absence of something, and that's leading to some of the problems that you've come to therapy to explore.
Now, if somebody is suffering with an addiction, I mean, in severe alcoholism, for example, just to mention one, they're obviously going to know deep down that they do have a problem. But for other people, it might not be quite so obvious that they've got a problem.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a good question because addicts can spend a huge amount of time in denial. So we, you know, our defenses to protect us from that admission. So again, it's very common. Someone will sit in my office and say, yeah, do you know what? I think I like a drink, but my friend Joe down the road, well, she drinks much more than me. Or I only drink because I work hard. So we find all of these cognitive distortions to justify that. And sadly for some people, they may never leave that phase of just living in denial. And their spouses who love them dearly will say, look, you have a problem, you have a problem. But we have to get to a point, you know, and they in recovery groups, they talk about reaching a rock bottom. And we have to reach that point where someone says, do you know what? I think I have a problem and I don't think I can solve this on my own.
So when you go out socially and you tell people you're a therapist, what's the reaction? Do people start pouring their hearts out to you?
One of two things. They either do that or they walk away very quickly because there's an assumption that, you know, you're going to analyze me. So, and it, of course, it doesn't work like that because if I'm not getting to know the person and their background and their childhood, but yeah, people have a strong reaction. I went to a dinner party once and there was only a few couples. I knew them all apart from one couple. And at the end of the evening, the wife came up to me and she said, I have to ask you a question. She was whispering like that. And I said, what is it? And she said, do you think my husband's having an affair? And I said, well, not with me. And I don't know. So yeah, strange reactions.
Well, we haven't solicited any questions this morning, but they've been coming in anyway. Catherine says, could you explain the idea of love languages and can married couples have different love languages? I don't even know what love language is, apart from give us a kiss. Love.
Well, I can do that later. But the love language was developed by a therapist, American therapist, always an American guy called John Gottman, and basically said that there are five love languages. And we will all have one, which is our primary love language. And that's the way that I like to be loved. And the five love languages are words of affirmation. So, you know, I love you, I appreciate you. Physical touch, receiving gifts. There's quality time and acts of service. And two things are interesting with love languages. The first is that when we get together in a relationship, it is really unusual for our partners to have the same primary love language as us. So very often couples will come to therapy and someone will say, you know, let's say the wife says, well, he just doesn't love me. He doesn't love me. That's why we're here. And he just looks at me in disbelief and says, I tell her every single day. I tell her that I love her. I've brought her gifts. Just last week, I brought flowers. And he looks at me like, come on, Gavin, you must get this. And then she'll say, but you don't do anything around the house. You never help with the school run. And so for her, her primary language is acts of service. And his may be words of affirmation. And so the goal, I guess, to love language is not that I want my partner to mirror my love language. It starts with me. I need to work out what's the love language of my partner and how is it that I can do things that will make my spouse, my partner, happy.
Mm. Interesting. And here's another question from Janet. My husband constantly criticises my body weight and shape. I've had 3 children and I'm not interested in being a supermodel. I'm happy with my weight and, by the way, I'm not obese. What are your thoughts?
You know, this is something I come across quite often, which is when one spouse puts the other down a lot. And without knowing huge amounts of detail, what I would say is what would concern me if someone like that came into my therapy room is this is kind of bordering on emotional abuse. Because if I heard that correct, the person who's writing in is saying, I'm okay, I'm happy with my body weight. And actually what my partner is doing is actually invalidating me. And when we put someone down, we order someone to feel differently, we begin to kind of label them, judge them, you know, we're kind of moving towards abuse. And sadly, it's something which is really common.
I can see we're not going to be able to clear this up in the next 2 minutes. So can you stick around till after the news? Would that
Absolutely,
be okay?
Absolutely, delighted to.
One further question. Why do we fall in love? I mean, chemically speaking, it's the pheromones, isn't it? Aren't there millions of pheromones buzzing around when people become attracted to each other and they're in the air and they mingle with each other and then it's too late? You can't stop it.
You see, you could do my job. you're absolutely right. We fall in love because we're hardwired to fall in love. Dopamine is one of the key chemicals that gets released. We fall in love because it feels good and we are wired. We come into the world, we're born seeking connection. You know, how once the infant is able to, the infant's looking for the mother's gaze. The infant's looking to be mirrored, to be cuckooed, all of those things. So we fall in love because we're biologically conditioned to. And as you said, it feels really good.
So is that some kind of an addiction as well, like the kind of the love buzz? I mean, you fall in love, you feel great. Everyone knows what it feels like to fall in love, but it doesn't last forever, does it? So what happens when it ends? Are you required to go and get that buzz somewhere else?
It's a good point. For some people, then they don't want the buzz to ever end. So actually, yes, some people are addicted to love. And I classify that as an intimacy disorder. So something happened in my childhood. And actually, rather than developing an addiction to alcohol, I just need this feeling of euphoria. And I can spend my life looking for, obsessing with the perfect relationship, the right woman, the right man. And I'm just going to keep on looking, and it becomes an endless pursuit, almost to the point where someone who's love addicted begins to neglect their own self-care. They begin to not pay attention to what's happening in their life. So it's one of those things that's hard to get our head around, because rationally we think, oh, come on, get real, addicted to love. But absolutely, people find that they're living these really unsatisfying lives because they haven't found a healthy, secure relationship.
Judith says, can you explain what is meant by the term gaslighting and how does this apply to relationships?
Yes, gaslighting is a form of psychological manipulation, and kind of picking up on the theme earlier when we're talking about emotional abuse. So there was a black and white movie in, I can't remember, 1940s, 1950s, and the plot was the husband wanted his wife's money. So he wanted to make her go crazy. So he would do things like he would dim the lights. And she'd say, oh, it's a bit dark in here. And he'd say, no, it's not, honey. Then he'd start playing music from the loft. And she'd be saying, I can hear music. And he'd be saying, no, you can't. There's no music here. And eventually, I haven't seen the movie, but I think she does end up in an asylum. I don't know whether he gets the money or not. So we coined the term gaslighting because so often in relationships, we get to this abusive situation where one partner is denying the other's reality. Happens a lot with affairs. You know, you said you'd be home at 7. No, I didn't. I told you I had. Don't you remember? I told you we had a meeting at 10.
It's not what you said last night.
Exactly. And that's what happens. And so, but eventually we continue to invalidate the other's experience. We continue to put them down. We continue to just really subtly do things to the point where somebody arrives in the therapy room and they actually really don't know if they're imagining that my husband's being abusive or is having an affair. It can be the other way around. And then gradually we unravel the reality and they start to come to terms with, you know, what's been a very traumatic experience.
So what is the definition of infidelity then? And some people will say it's, you know, looking at pornography in the internet. That's enough for them. That's, you've crossed the line. You know, you've been sort of unfaithful to me in cyberspace. But, you know, how does it start and what is the boundary?
It's a great question. And it's, you know, we could be all day talking about infidelity. And, you know, your point's a good one because there was a time when we kind of knew what infidelity was. And it was, you know, if I'm having a relationship outside of my marriage, that broadly speaking is infidelity. But you're right, I can be in bed with my spouse and being unfaithful. Because if I am watching porn on my phone or on my computer, or I am WhatsApping the secretary at work or the guy from does the deliveries, I don't know, whatever it is, then is that infidelity? And in some respects, every couple has to kind of define, if they're in a monogamous relationship, what is infidelity? But broadly speaking, I would say that it's a breach of trust. And I would say that if we're doing something that is secretive rather than private, then there is a pretty good chance, you know, and there's an emotional, you know, it's an emotional affair, or I'm just, it could be pornography. But if I'm doing something secretive that my spouse wouldn't approve, I'd say we're getting pretty close to a definition of infidelity.
Mm. Paola says, my husband and I are very much in love. The only thing we argue about are his parents. They drive us crazy. They show up unannounced and expect to see the children every weekend. My husband doesn't know how to say no. It drives me nuts. I married him, not his parents. Well, luckily, my mother-in-law is in Canada. Not that I don't love her dearly, but she can't just pop over for the weekend, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I just heard she's on the way over.
Ah! Let's go ahead and tidy the house.
It's, again, really common issue, which is about family. This is around boundaries, and this is an issue. We think boundaries are something that we have to control other people, and actually boundaries are about you. And the boundaries are, Brené Brown is a US researcher and therapist, and she just captures it beautifully. And she says, boundaries are what's okay for me and what's not okay in a relationship. And if I have low self-esteem, if I'm slightly fearful of rejection, I'm fearful of confrontation, I suck up a lot of stuff. You know, lots of people pleasers have really poor boundaries because there's this sense of, I just don't want to disappoint other people. And the problem in that scenario is that the, I can't remember which way around it was, but the person who's frustrated with the in-laws, the more they don't express their needs, the more resentment is going to build up. And that's when we get to that point where there's the infamous Christmas dinner and it all comes out and everybody suddenly is screaming and shouting and, you know, for the last 20 years, you've always done this. And because if I don't get a chance to express my needs and I can't establish healthy boundaries, I'm going to be resentful. And when we do that, we're not being true to ourselves. So it's a tricky one, and it's very cultural sometimes because in certain ethnic families, in certain religions, there is an expectation that we're all going to live in each other's pockets, and it's arguably not that healthy.
Now, men are notoriously bad about taking themselves to the doctors when they're not feeling well. I do it all the time. You know, mm-hmm. Shoulder injuries, get better on its own, and then your arm falls off and you think, I should have gone before. But is that the same with psychotherapy? I mean, what's your mix of clients? Do more women come to see you or more men?
It's pretty mixed. I would say that it's probably 60-40 in a favor of women coming through the door. There are differences because there are so many different gender expectations. I think men, you know, there's an irony here, Rob, because the suicide rate for men is, I think it's something like 3 times higher than it is for women. But we just are not very good, as you said, at asking for help. I think the way it plays out in the therapy room is men are very much goal-oriented. So they don't really, you know, I say things like trust the process and we're going to go on some kind of psychological journey together. And they look at me like I am Paul McKenna. I've just said voodoo. But the men want to be there. We're very goal-oriented. Okay, so where are we in the therapy? How many sessions? You know, should I come in next week with a plan? And so I think the way it acts out, because as men, one of the most common gender norms is don't express your feelings, because we express our feelings, that would make us weak. It would make us feminine. Now, I mean, women have their own set of norms, but for men, it sometimes takes a while. We don't really want to delve too much in the past. Stay with the here and now, but I don't need to talk about that stuff over there, you know, the feelings things, you know. So it plays out differently, but we get there in the end.
Talking about men, Sebastian is wondering, if Donald Trump was your client, how would you treat him? It's a good question, isn't it, really?
Oh, boy. Yeah, I'd say, you know what, my practice is full right now. I think I need to be careful because there must be libel laws here. Look, I think people like Donald Trump, let's make an assumption that people like Donald Trump rather than Donald Trump, have this kind of narcissistic side to them. And they're really difficult to work with. It's a little bit like the addict in denial. The capacity for someone who is narcissistic to self-reflect is very limited. So, you know, what I do in the therapy room is I kind of hold a mirror up to someone and say, you know, can you see this pattern? And the irony with narcissists is, on one side, there's this puffed up, there's this sense of kind of superiority to them, and they're so great. And the flip side is that it stems from a absolute fear of being rejected and a deep insecurity. And the challenge of working with narcissists is if you pierce that narcissistic bubble too early on, they will have a breakdown. They will collapse because you're asking them to accept something that they've never been able to accept. So I suspect the chances of someone like Donald Trump coming through are quite limited, because unless a crisis has prompted him, I think I just heard on your news broadcast, today's the day of impeachment, so you never know. But unless a crisis has really pushed that person to come through the door, someone like that is not that likely to come through.
Apparently they're pretty happy, though. There was an article last week saying they may be fairly unpleasant people, but they're all really happy.
I saw that, and I think on one level, that is probably true. But again, if you go back to your opening question to me about kind of in the corporate world, I would say prima facie, I was quite happy. And I was enjoying, I was running my own company and all that kind of stuff. And then kind of when I took a deep look, there was something there that, you know what, I wasn't that fulfilled. So some of my male clients are businessmen here in Monaco, and they're running, you know, extremely successful businesses, and they're always waiting for the next deal, the next deal, the next deal. And I say to them, at what point are you going to pause? Because it doesn't strike me that the last one brought you that much happiness. So what you're living for is not for today. You're living for the thing that's going to come next. So where's the joy in the present moment? And you, if you're lucky enough, you kind of get that look of, yeah, I'm now in touch with my sadness.
Well, it's obviously a great deal of interest in this subject, so we're right out of time, but we must do it again. But
yeah, I'd love to.
I'm sure a lot of people would like to find out how they can contact you and make an appointment to see you.
Yeah, absolutely. So my website is livelovelearn.global. My email is gavin@livelovelearn.global. I have a workshop on this Saturday, a half-day workshop on boundaries. And on the 28th of November, there is a free seminar, which is the 10 Secrets to a Happy Relationship. That's in Monaco at Crème. So please feel free to come along, say hello. And Rob, huge thanks to you and Sarah for having me on this morning. It's a real privilege.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Gavin, and I hope to talk to you again soon.